Good evening and welcome to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute. I'm Anthony Wong, Program Coordinator of the Institute. Thank you very much, everyone, for joining us tonight for our very special panel on the topic, Understanding Communities Discriminated on Work and Descent, Global Perspectives and Emerging Normative Frameworks. And joining us are our guest speakers tonight, Paul Divakar, Namala, Queen Bessing, Gabriella Harabanova, Bina Palakal, and Johannes Boucher. And also joining us tonight will be, and giving introductions, is Swati Savant, Esquire, immigration lawyer and caste equity advocate.
Jai Bhim, Opre Roma, Uhuru, Salve, Lentai.
Jai Bhim, Opre Roma, Salve, Uhuru, Lentai.
So, all the slogans. On behalf of the Asian American Asian Research Institute at the City University of New York and the Global Forum of Communities Discriminated on Work and Descent, that's G4, together with the Inclusivity Project, it is my great pleasure to welcome all of you to this important seminar on understanding communities discriminated on work and descent, global perspective, and emerging normative frameworks. We are delighted to welcome scholars, students, community leaders, human rights practitioners, policymakers, and friends who have joined us this evening. Your presence reflects a growing interest in understanding one of the world's least recognized yet most enduring forms of structural inequality. Across continents and across very different societies, millions of people continue to experience discrimination because of the inherited status, descent, or ancestral occupation. Although these systems are known by different names in different regions, they often produce remarkably similar outcomes. Communities face exclusion from education, employment, housing, political participation, public services, and equal opportunities simply because of the circumstances of their birth. This seminar seeks to deepen our understanding of these realities through a truly global perspective. It brings together voices working with Dalit communities in South Asia, Roma communities in Europe, slavery descendant communities in Africa, Kilombola and Afro descendant communities in Latin America, and many others those who experience challenges to think beyond national boundaries and to recognize common patterns of inherited discrimination. This conversation is particularly timely. Around the world, there is a growing recognition that these forms of discrimination deserve greater visibility within international human rights law and policy. At the United Nations and within regional human rights system, important discussions are now underway about how existing human rights standards can better respond to these long-standing injustices. Academic institutions, civil society organizations, and affected communities all have an essential role to play in shaping that future. This evening's seminar reflects exactly that spirit of dialogue. It brings together lived experience, scholarship, policy expertise, and international advocacy to help us better understand both the diversity of these communities and the common challenges they face. We are especially grateful to the Asian American Asian Research Institute for partnering with Global Forum of Communities Discrimination on Work, that G4, and the Inclusivity Project in convening this important discussion. And we thank everyone who has contributed to making this event possible. It is now my pleasure to introduce our moderator. Paul Divakar Namala is Executive Director of the Inclusivity Project and convener of the Global Forum of Communities Discriminated on Work and Descent. For more than three decades, he has worked internationally to advance the rights of the communities affected by caste, descent-based discrimination, and inherited status systems. His leadership has helped bring these issues before the United Nations and numerous international human rights mechanisms, and he continues to play a leading role in advancing emerging global normative frameworks on these issues. Joining him this evening are an outstanding panel of distinguished speakers. Queen Biseng, Africa Coordinator of the Inclusivity Project and Global Forum of Communities Discriminated on Work and Descent, whose work focuses on communities affected by slavery, descendant status, and other inherited forms of exclusion across Africa. Gabriela Habanova, Executive Director of the Ergo Network, one of Europe's leading Roma-led organizations, and a respected advocate for Roma equality, inclusion, and human rights. Beena Palikal, General Secretary of the National Campaign on Dalit Human Rights in India, an internationally recognized Dalit feminist leader whose work has significantly advanced the rights of Dalit women and marginalized communities. Johannes Butcher, a human rights and development practitioner based in Colombia, whose work with Quilombola, Palenque, and other Afro-descendant communities has contributed greatly to comparative understanding across regions. We are deeply honored to have such an exceptional group of speakers with us this evening, bringing perspective from Africa, Europe, Asia, and Latin America. Without further delay, it is my great pleasure to invite our moderator, Paul Divakar Namala, to lead us through this important discussion. Thank you, and I wish everyone a stimulating and inspiring seminar.
Thank you, Swati, for a brief but comprehensive introduction of all. That saves us time not to again introduce, but they're very renowned anyway. You just click their photograph and send it to the net, and you will have their history. But thank you very much to you, Swati, for bringing us together and for engaging with the Asian Research Institute for this conversation. I was just asking Justin, how do you feel this? He says, oh, the boredom of you, and this is such a breath of fresh air to be able to have. So it is indeed, because for the last 3 days we've been saying, and, you know, those are very tailored words. You know, we are given 2 minutes, sometimes even less, and even 1 minute more, they will cut off the mics. So this is a space for us to not just talk about ourselves, though maybe little we'll have to do. I hope Dinesh will help us maintain the time so that we don't go overboard, but we leave space for more interaction, and we'd like to be as interactive as possible. Let me begin with a challenge. If someone has stood before this audience about, say, 10, 15 years ago and suggested that Dalits in South Asia, Roma in Europe, Haratin and other descendant communities of inherited status in Africa, Buraku in Japan, Quilombola in Brazil, Palenque in Colombia, Ozu community in Nigeria, and many others across the world, that they are together requesting or demanding a common global human rights framework, most of us would have agreed. But actually, before this began, when I was explaining that these systems agree, there are some people who are saying no. Many of these religions, including Islam, are so, they practice equality. And when I started growing up, I used to believe also that this whole caste system is only present in my area, and that is unique and nowhere else. So the differences that we imagined at that time are too vast. What is even now, when we are engaging together, what are you saying? Okay, I can understand Dalits, but separately I can understand also about Roma. But why are you two coming together? Now, international experts, independent experts of the Committee for Elimination of Racial Discrimination, a UN treaty body, who has pronounced this for a long time, the lived experience when we are telling them, look here, bring us all into one umbrella, because for too long we have been kept isolated away. And we need us to come, because isolated, we are very minuscule. Our own governments, wherever they are, they say, no, don't touch them. This is our issue. It's our culture, part of our culture. We know how to deal with it. Thousands of years it has been there. Now we are a democratic country. We have a law. But on the ground, it's not, nothing is, really much, not much has changed. You know, the inherited stigma because of these structures still affect us. Even though my forefathers or mothers have not been forced into these stigmatized occupations which they did, and I don't do it anymore, I'm still, when I go near, they'll close their nose. Just to, you know, because we've been pushed into all indignified occupations. So the differences, our histories are different, cultures are different, legal systems are different, and even languages. We have I've got a 2-minute notification. So languages are different. But now the landscape has changed so much. When Queen and I go together to people, no more are they asking, why you two together? When Gabriella and we, and together we are doing, they are not, because they now understand the regions are different, but the social hierarchies in which differently but very similarly they are being practiced are very important for any, leave alone academic, leave alone independent, but any human being with some kind of any sense of natural justice cannot tolerate this system. So that's why we said we'd come together with different languages, but we'll come together. We have made tremendous progress, and I would really like to commend both Queen and also the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. Many of our other countries said, no, don't touch this, this is our own. They said, no, this practice is against the fundamental human rights that we have given ourselves together as when we formed the African Union. But it is present, so we want to examine. So a resolution was passed, but then Queen will share more about that. So there is several things that are happening, but we will also share with you the kind of stigma, occupational segregation, social exclusion, denial of dignity, and violence, extreme, gruesome violence. People killing each other, parents killing their children because they had married outside the caste. And this has happened across several of these, including Ozu community in Nigeria. So today, this discussion, we hope to explore the experiences of Dalits, Roma, Haratin. We don't have people from Japan, Buraku, but Pelenke and Kilambola, and Johannes is very careful that I don't want to take their, to represent them, but I'm in solidarity. And Johannes is also from Latin America, and partly he's a colonizer from Germany, so excuse me. So we are here trying to see how these challenges, we can bring them together. And so, before he says stop, I really invite you to these treaties of hearing Unfortunately, they also have 8 minutes, so please look at, don't evade looking at Dinesh, but over to you, and thank you very much. After all of them speak, we have given quite a lot of time for free and flow discussion, and and we look forward to a discussion. Over to Queen, who has already been introduced.
Well, I'm happy to be here and also very happy to share about these systems in Africa. It's very important to also note that across Africa, the system and the history is a long-standing one, where there is inherited status and occupational hierarchy, where these communities that Paul already mentioned are victim of social stratification, structural inequalities, and discrimination. Though they differ from one region to another, one country to another, but they have the common features where they are actually stripped of their humanity, regarded as lesser human beings because of who they are, where they were born to be, their identity, their occupation, their descent, and the work they do. Some of these communities face the common characteristics that Paul already mentioned, the issue of endogamy, segregation, and also the notion of purity and pollution. Africa has 55 countries, but so far we're able to identify the existence of these communities in about 23 of them. We mentioned also in Nigeria, the Aratin in Mauritania, the Fuga in Ethiopia, the Bela in Mali, the Wolof in Senegal, some of these Fulanis and the Mefu in Cameroon, and right up to northern Africa with the Shwashing in Liberia, Morocco, and Algeria. For the sake of time, I just want to share some few examples because I think it's better to share life experiences for you to better understand what these communities are going through. If I should come back with the case of Gambia, where we have the Komos, who are victims of segregation, not by the masters, not by the colons, but where pre-colonial form of slavery is still very existing. When you get into the community, you can differentiate by color, by the body color, by the religion. You can't even differentiate by the difference of the houses, so you will not say those living in the left have mansions and those living in the right side have huts. They all look alike, but because of the identity, because of the slave caste, because of your name, a particular group regards themselves as nobles and dominant, and they actually segregate some people, they force to accept that they are slaves. When these people refuse to bear that name, that I am a slave, they face physical aggressions because we have cases where the dominant meet the slave on the way and ask them to kneel down, their hands on their head, and say, "Repeat after me, I am a slave." When this person denies to do so, he's been beaten up and the hell out of him. They have been denied of going to the same schools because they are the slave. They don't go to the same worship places. They don't go to the same market. They don't even share public areas together. They are discriminated and segregated even at death because when they die, they have separate graveyards. When the women go to the market to sell, buying from them is a privilege. If a bottle of water is $100, they can take it for $25 because no one will buy. So it's a privilege to buy from them. Other examples are in Mauritania, the Aratin, where the slave forgerons, the blacksmiths, have their children serving the master from one generation to another. Why the young girls serve in homes to the masters as unpaid workers and actually victims of abuses, and these masters have the capacity to sell this young girl to another family or to another master if they get rid of them. The young boys work in agricultural farmlands to pay for the debts that their forefathers contracted. And they will never know when they end paying this until the masters decide so. The Wahaya case in Niger, where women are used as sexual objects, as they are being bought by masters to serve as wives, fourth fit wife in a home, not to enjoy the privileges of a married woman, but to be the slave of the family, doing all the labor, the work, and being slave to the other wife of the man. In the course when a child is being born, that child automatically becomes a slave of the family and has nothing to inherit when the father dies. They do agricultural work, and this is simply because they are from these communities, communities discriminated on work and decent. And let me take this last example, the Ewe community from Ghana, with the same example from the Osu community in Nigeria, where young girls within the age of 10 to 22 are given to serve in the shrine to pay for the sin, as an atonement to pay for the sin that a member of their family has committed or they themselves. They serve in this shrine until when the chief priest decide that they can get their freedom. While they are there, they don't have the right to visit their families, maybe one time a year, maybe during December. And when the family member comes to give the food, he actually ends at the entrance of the shrine, and someone takes it to the lady inside. While she's there for 12 years, for 14 years, she doesn't have access to education. And when the priest decides that she's free, the society rejects her because she has served in the shrine. She is untouchable. She is very impure. And while she's there, she's victim of all forms of abuses, exploitation, like all what is inhuman that a lady can go through. One last example, because I have 1 minute, is the Mefu community, the Goda community in Cameroon, where we have manual scavengers, animal carcass removers, and grave diggers, which their forefathers did many years ago. But because they are descendants from these families, they are regarded as untouchable. No one come across them. They can't intermarry. And touching them is believed that the person will contract maybe a disease or chickenpox. It's alleged to be so. So I am not talking about past histories. I am talking about things that are existing now. The good news I can bring is that in 2024, we're able to approach the organ of the African Commission called the African, the organ of the African Union called the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, where we had a lot of advocacy, where the commissioners of the commission were still finding it difficult to believe that this still exists within the African society. You know, they are ministers, they are high profile persons in their countries, but they were still finding it difficult to believe that this exists. So we had to push, share resources, but what triggered the resolution was when we brought people from the community to share their life experiences. It wasn't someone saying, it wasn't someone's story, but they came from Komo, they came from Osu, they came from Aratin, they came from Ewe, and they said, this is what I am facing. And the chairperson said, we are going to adopt the resolution. And in November 2024, the resolution 619 was adopted on the promotion and the protection of the right of communities discriminated on work and decent. It is a milestone. There is still a lot to be done because the African Commission committed to conduct a study to identify these communities and call state members to address it. The challenge remains the invisibility, the lack of data, and also the lack of these legal and specific frameworks to protect them. Thank you so much.
I've had the privilege and opportunity, or whatever you call that, of walking along with Queen. But as she's speaking today, I still feel, you know, there is something, so wrong with our society in the world. That not that it is happening, but people like us and many others in governance are still trying to invisibilize and not recognize and see that this has to be addressed. And another shocking incidents you will hear So over to Gabriela Hrabanova from Czech Republic, but currently she's a dear partner to the Global Forum and a leader of the network called European Roma Grassroots Organizations Network. Over to you, Gabby.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here today. And as was said, I'm coming from Europe. And I think that very often when we think about Europe, we think about kind of a place where the equality, democracy, and human rights are already secured. And Europe is also very often playing this sort of exporter of the human rights. But I think that very often we don't see, or it's not so much visible, those invisible people which Roma might be there. So we see that Europe has built some strong human rights frameworks, but we have about 12 million Roma who are continuing living in segregation. They are being discriminated, and they are excluded from the passes from one generation to another. I have been myself working on the Roma rights for more than 20 years at the national level, European level, but also increasingly now at the global level, thanks to the Global Forum. And one of the things that I really learned is that we cannot explain the situation of Roma very simply through the poverty. Although we would say, and I think that's somehow the fact that we are facing, there is a fundamental rights agency, that this is an agency of the European Union that is being analyzing and making research on the situation of different minorities, including Roma. And they're saying that practically 83% of Roma children are living at the risk of poverty. Mm-hmm. And 83% of our children, which is like incredible number. And almost one in three children live in a household where someone went to bed hungry in the previous months. So Roma are not poor by the accident. When Roma children are still disproportionately placed in the segregated schools. So about 46% of Roma children are in the schools with mostly Roma children. So practically the segregation is happening there. Roma families are pushed into segregated neighborhoods where people are denied jobs because of their name, because of their addresses, or because they're just simply recognized as Roma. And we are not talking only about poverty. It's 56% of young Roma, aged from 16 to 24, they are neither in employment, education, or training, compared to 11% of the general population. So 56, 11. So it's a huge gap that we need to work with. So we are actually talking about the system, where the same communities remain at the bottom of the social hierarchy, from generation to generation. And it is also where I see an important connection with the wider conversation we have about the communities, with the other communities discriminated on work and descent, because, of course, the Roma experience, it may be different from the Dalits or from the Haratins in Africa. But we should not erase those differences, but we should come together and we should recognize something in each other. And the fact that we can recognize that when a child cannot inherit not only the identity and the culture of the family, but they also inherit the prejudices against the family. And I think that by recognizing, it means that when stereotypes following the communities from generation, this is also our responsibility that we are taking further. So we have to work with institutions, schools, address labor markets, housing systems, and sometimes even the public authorities, because these are those who are reproducing these inequalities. And when very often even though the equality is guaranteed by the law. So for me, in this, the value to work with the CDWD framework, it gives us a possibility to look beyond individual discrimination, but also to ask more difficult question. Why do the same communities remain excluded generation after generation? In Europe, we had Roma strategies, we have national action plan, we have funding programs for decades. Some of them have brought important progress, but the fundamental pattern has not disappeared. Too often, we try to help Roma people to navigate unequal systems instead of asking why these systems continue to discriminate. And then that our experience is telling that this is not that we need to fight it. We need to face it altogether. So Roma are also moving from one European country to another. So we are living in the context of exclusion. In some countries, actually, they found a better understanding, but practically the stereotypes are still coming back, even though they moved to a different country. So it's not automatically disappearing. So that's why I believe that this global conversation that we are building, it's important. We have to learn from each other. Roma movements, we developed a lot of experiences in the European advocacy on fighting anti-gypsism. So anti-gypsism for us is the specific form of discrimination or racism that is being faced, that Roma are facing. But the Dalit movements also bring extraordinary legal and political strategies as well as the others. So if we learn from each other, if we bring these experiences together, we are facing the human, it's our global human rights challenge. So for me, we have to shape this this conversation more, but also to understanding the systems of exclusion. So each of us sitting here today, we are bringing those experiences to the table. But also I know that many of us, or like the way the work we are presenting, it's not just about complaining, but it's about putting our recommendations and our work forward to make the change for the real people, to make the real change. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabby, very clearly bringing out the specificities but also the commonness of how we have reproduced these structures of inherited inequality wherever we have formed so-called advanced societies. So however advanced it is, that much more invisibilization of these practices continue even today. So thank you very much. And now I request Beena Pallikal has been introduced, but just to say that along with the National Campaign on Dalit Human Rights, which she heads in India, she's also currently the chair of the Asia Dalit Rights Forum, along with Bhakta, who is here, or who was here. Yes, over to Beena on the aspect of caste and the persistent forms of discrimination based on work and descent.
Jai Bheem to all of you. While I was listening to Queen talk about the situation of young girls in Africa, I couldn't stop but think of the similar situation of Dalit girls in India and young Dalit children who are growing up. Many times when we go for our work in the field and we ask young children, you know, what they want to be, all of them, you know, tell they want to be doctors, they want to be not so many scientists because, you know, they might have heard only of doctor, engineer, etc. But many times when you look at their eyes, there's a lot of aspiration, you know, to grow, to become somebody in life. But then you look at the situation and you see that, you know, many times now it's rainy season, it's, you know, it's a lot of, because of the climate change, there's a lot of disasters happening in India, like floods. And many of the people who are most affected by this are from the community. So when you look at where they're living, when you look at the situation, you often wonder, you know, how is this child going to grow up? What is this child going to grow up into? But how many different barriers they have to cross to be able to become somebody in life? And a couple of weeks ago, I got a call. We get a lot of distress calls from different parts of the country. And this distress call was particularly very sad because it was an 18-year-old young boy who was in love. He was a Dalit boy who was in love with a girl from the dominant caste. And the call was that, you know, he has been killed. He has been murdered, and we need to go and see what kind of a support to be given to him. So while this was in a state which is Uttarakhand, which is like the north of India, and I don't have a team in Uttarakhand, so I had to call my team in Himachal and immediately send them to Uttarakhand. It was like, it was a long journey from there. But while the case caught a lot of attention and is getting a lot of attention, because apart from killing him for love, I mean, probably India is one country where love can kill. You know, if you fall in love with somebody who's not of your caste, you know, you can be killed. I mean, rest assured you can be killed. It was particularly hard-hitting, this case, because they not only killed him, but they tortured him by pulling out his nails with pliers and by, putting nails into his body. And I just, like, 2 days ago while I was here in New York, I got a report from my team to say how heinous this crime was. Now, what do you do? What do you say? I mean, how do you address this, right? What is the call that you want to make? You know, how do you tell people that, you know, I think it was, there's about 264 different types of crimes that are happening, from everything from listening to a song that is played by a song of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, mm-hmm. who's one of our heroes. He's similar to like Martin Luther King in India. To, you know, falling in love, to, you know, eating, to having a cook in the school. Mm-hmm. You know, children will not come to school if the cook of the school is, you know, there's these different forms of discrimination and violence that is happening in the country. And sometimes it feels like a really hopeless situation. Mm-hmm. And many people ask, you know, why we come to UN, why we come here. You know, it's not an easy life for us, you know. I was just telling my friends that back home I have all my comforts, you know. I drive around, you know, but here in New York I walk like 10 to 15,000 steps every day, which I don't want to do, you know. I'm forced to do it because there's no car or there's no driver who comes and picks me up. So I think we're here because we want to tell the world that despite the fact that India and countries in South Asia are on the upward, you know, or development map. India is one of the countries that is the fastest growing economy in the world today. Everybody wants to trade with India. Everybody wants to, you know, have businesses in India. Everybody thinks that India is a very critical country to look at when it comes to trade and economy. But this is what is happening on the ground. And unless we address this, I don't think that we can talk about development. Development is not about building roads and building buildings. And, you know, development is also about that no kid should die of malnutrition. You know, development is also about that, like what Gabby said, intergenerational poverty. When is that you're going to, you know, stop this intergenerational poverty? When is it that you're going to say that no child should go hungry, like what Gabby says? The same thing happens in India as well. There are so many children who go to sleep hungry. There are so many children who wake up to a life that probably they would have never thought about, you know, but then history has brought them to that. It's not their fault that they're born as a Dalit. As a Dalit woman, you know, we all have spent many, many, many years and many days and nights, sleepless nights, to think about what is happening on the ground. And therefore, like, all of us have come together to address the situation globally and to come together and form the strong solidarity and come under the umbrella of communities discriminated on work and dissent. We are here to look at the Sustainable Development Goals and the conversation around this at the UN. And it said that if India and Asia doesn't address the SDG goals, it'll never get addressed. the 2030 agenda will never be complete without it first being addressed within the Asia, because Asia has the highest number of any of these indicators. If you take Asia, has the lowest in these indicators. Just to quickly say that, you know, within this, women face, you know, severe forms of intersectional discrimination, so class, caste, and often religion. I must say, in Nepal, in India and Nepal, we have excellent constitutional mandates, both legal mandates as well as social mandates, but yet discrimination and violence continues unabated. In Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, there is still more, you know, there should be more legal provisions, but, you know, there are people fighting on the ground for that. Asians have built solidarity through the Asia Dalit Rights Forum and several other regional forums, but yet we think that coming together globally will only strengthen our struggle. Keeping our individual identities, me as Dalit, Gabby as Roma, or Queen as somebody from the Haratin community, and of course we have Latin American communities as well. Keeping our unique identities, we continue to move forward and surge forward, coming together to build this movement, to look and push for inclusion in these spaces which are extremely opaque, which are extremely difficult for my sisters and brothers from India to actually come and engage. So here we are. We're calling all of you to join us in the struggle as we move forward under the Global Forum of Communities Discriminated and Work in Dissent. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Beena. That's one of the criticisms we are facing. Maybe we can discuss it during the open floor, that by joining this, you're doing an injustice to Dalits, because caste is so visible and it's now gaining ground. So you people are maybe sponsored by some government to dilute the issue. Now, how there are ways of criticizing even some of the things that are so genuine and these efforts. So, thank you for sharing. But then I think it's really important that we are now addressing together, all of us, around 330 million people who are together as communities discriminated on work and dissent. Probably the world's largest group in number are marginalized, but equally cruel systems. But thank you for bringing it out. And over to Johannes, who is bringing the whole issue of communities discriminated on work and dissent in the Latin American context, the Afro-descendant Quilombola and Palenque experience. Over to you, Johannes.
I maybe want to start by setting a little bit the scene globally, because what we just heard is maybe in practice what we may call academically norm entrepreneurship. It's building a new human rights norm based on a shared experience that may not share a single social origin. And that may kind of sound familiar to you, because there is a really successful movement that has achieved that, and that's the indigenous movement. In Latin America, the communities that face discrimination based on work and descent are not indigenous, despite having their own language often, not always, their own culture and their own traditions, but are not considered indigenous as such. But going back to the indigenous, it's kind of a good question to look at them and see what do North American indigenous people have in common with Australian indigenous people. You might say they are also very different in terms of their tradition, in terms of their practices and so on, but they're united in a shared experience and identity that they have adopted. And it's a similar effort that we're trying to do here today. Collective rights are much better to defend if they are based on a shared experience. Invisibility is easy to achieve when you want to forget, when you want to lock up, and when you just want to not think about a problem or what you may call a problem in that sense of a community who has been excluded systematically. So these kind of activities which we do is trying to unite different people based on a shared experience to create a new norm that is recognized, that ensures the rights. Because once you can systematize a way of oppression, you can design institutional mechanisms to defend against it, be it at the UN with different monitoring tools, be it at the national level where you have specific programs or incentives to ensure that the diversity is ensured in society and that everyone who is part of that society is allowed to have their fair share and is not discriminated against. So maybe with this backdrop, I want to repeat again that I speak here in a place of solidarity with these communities, working alongside them and working with them, and share a little bit more about them, in particular in Latin America. We have a history in Latin America that is that is really very much coined by the colonial powers who came to the continent, exploited it systematically, and brought people there who were forced to work on various fields of labor. So that's the forced labor element that all these communities have in common, either in the present times or ancestrally. Different expression of that can be found amongst all these communities that relate work to the descent, and that's why also this name, which is kind of a little bit bulky, but has been the best name we have found of communities discriminated on work and descent. In Latin America, it's the Palenque in Colombia, which have a very rich history of resistance to the colonial powers, and have one place, San Basilio de Palenque, which is kind of the origin story of that specific community that opposed the oppressors and united, in a way, the resistance. In Brazil, we have the Quilombola communities, making about 1.3 million people in the country, and having a similar history that is against oppression and also to do with forced labor in specific areas. Maybe also to mention that the Roma community that my colleague spoke so eloquently of is also present across the continent and is not only in Europe. And it's important to note that in Latin America, the same issues are faced by the communities that my colleague Gabi described about systematic exclusion and oppression that we find in Europe is translated also into the Latin American context in that sense. So I think I'll stop here because I think we may have a little bit of a more of an interactive dialogue with all of you to understand the issue more. Just maybe in closing, I can also show what we have achieved in terms of norm entrepreneurship. A policy paper was published together with UN Women, uniting all of the experiences of the different communities in recognition of the shared struggle and similar experience despite not sharing a single social origin. And I think this document, authored by our dear colleague Dr. Simona Torotskoy and inputs from all the teams present here, is really one of the most remarkable documents because it puts into practice the things we have been saying about similar experiences and uniting them in a single document that might be the basis for a declaration at the UN, but also many other national laws which ensures and protects the rights of all these communities that face discrimination based on work and descent. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Johannes, for not only talking about the Latin American experience, but in a way you have summed up some of the key things that we are trying to do. So, friends, I think let me open up the floor. So, a few challenges still, I think. So, one of the things that some of us have said is, how do you build a global network without erasing the differences and without erasing the specificities, which are very clear, but you also need a solidarity and a kind of a handle, a common umbrella, which we can lift it together. Otherwise, you have to lift each of us and several other identities. So how do you do this? It's one challenge. Probably some of you would have some insights. How do you respond to community identities while recognizing the structural patterns that are also a little different. And then most important, which we are now trying to do, both the African context with the Africa Resolution 619, which was passed, and also now we are working towards a new norm at the UN within the framework of the International Covenant for Elimination of Racial Discrimination through a general recommendation, which is actually a new law on communities discriminated on work and descent. So how will the new norm be able to take the commonalities as well as the distinct patterns, but still ensure they have justice, not just on paper at the UN, but they can be able to pluck that out and then adopt it into each country situation. Because without that, the global norm is of no use, or even the paper on which it may be written. So how do we do this? You know, it's a very, one is we are coming together, but then how do you make this a norm which will then stick to the ground, to the people who are experiencing on a day-to-day? So some of the questions, but you might have completely a different set of questions, so please don't hesitate. The first one who gets will have 1 minute more to talk.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank all of you and Swati and everyone for having this very important dialogue and panel. I know personally, just from watching Swati, how hard she's worked around this theme. And I have to say that I'll try to make this as brief as I can, but as everyone spoke, I thought about how I'm working on something that has to do with genocide and the gendered aspects of genocide and looking at the different genocides that have occurred. And the question is, well, why does it continue? Why does this still happen? What's happening in the world? And I think oftentimes we look at things as, well, it's happening over there to those people, not us. You know, if you look at different, you know, if you look at Rwanda, if you look at what happened in, you know, Yugoslavia, if you look at different countries. But I think the importance, to be succinct, the importance of what you're doing is that you are instilling a culture of collaboration against impunity, where you acknowledge shared experiences, you acknowledge the right to collaborate and acknowledge your individual experiences, but you understand the overarching threat that looms, that if it's not acknowledged on a very international level, and not just with respect to the issue of caste per se, but its intersectionality, which in that report that you mentioned with UN Women, its intersectionality with other types of injustices that occur. And so it's not just, even though in and of itself that would be important, but the more you educate people, leaders, spiritual, religious leaders, churches, institutions, about the intersectionality and how one thing impacts everything else, the more you transform a culture. And so I think it's important. I mean, I could say more about it, but I want to just, I'm inspired, and yet at the same token, I'll be very honest with you. I'm a bit disheartened. I'm disheartened because we're in 2026 and something as basic as this it's hard for me to put this into words, but I've seen how I don't understand how people don't really understand that what's happening over there is affecting you just because you're part of this. If you're swimming in an ocean and there's dirt in the ocean, we all get infected regardless. So, I mean, more to say, but
just
I...
A word about yourself.
Oh, me. Oh, hi. I'm Faye Paris. I co-chair. I'm with the Women's Bar Association, but I'm here as a supporter of this issue. I feel very strongly about, I'm within the legal community. I do a lot of different things, different hats in the community, but I just feel as though this is the start or the continuation, I should say, of what needs to happen. And one last thing I will say, and then I want to hand it to someone else. But what I love about this group, and I think, Swati, you've heard my favorite saying with Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, when she chaired the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, she says, where, after all, do human rights begin? In small spaces so close to home, so close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world, yet they are the world of the individual person, the farm, factory, or office where they work, the school that they attend. Such are the spaces where every man, woman, and child seeks equal dignity, equal justice, without discrimination. Without these rights, and I'm paraphrasing it, but without these rights, without concerted, is her word, citizen action to uphold these rights close to home, we shall look in vain for progress in the farther world. And this is what you're doing, so thank you.
I'm Amy McKeown. I'm working in a new project related to nutrition and more transparency around recycling, just nutrition in general. And I started paying more attention to labels, for example, fair trade labels. I've been buying chocolate from Madagascar that's organic. It comes from Colombia as well. It comes from Belgium, but they also source some of their products from like South America or Africa. And there is a fair trade label. But I've always wondered, do these types of labels that come kind of from the West and transparency, are they known about in Africa? Are they known about in Colombia or South America, where the chocolate comes from? I mean, do these types of labels make a difference? Do they improve your life? It just seems really far removed at the micro level. And I'm wondering if increased transparency is improving the situation where you're from. So,
thank you. Sorry, your name?
It's Amy.
Amy.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, is it okay if we note it, but we will address it?
Sure.
After gathering a few, I mean, Faye was mostly a comment, isn't it?
It was mostly a comment, and then, you know, just to show that I'm very inspired with what you're doing and ideas, you know, of continuing what you do of Faye.
Yeah. So we will, it's a very important question.
I mean, I do have a question,
please.
Which is this. Have you contacted... So what is the response on the, I use the word spiritual religious, like kind of separate, but the various leaders within various communities. So within that camp, and then also those who are in security forces. I'd be curious to know, is there any kind of discussion going on within those two specific groups?
Okay, we'll have two things. So what is the response of the faith bodies? And also those organizations who are looking at the security, per se.
Religious, spiritual,
as these two. Towards these forms of exclusion.
And addressing it and being educated, have they, you know, that type of
thing. Yeah, that's one. Mm-hmm. And also Amy's question of, there is so much citizens' action on the issues of fair trade, and they talk to countries. I'm paraphrasing what you say. Countries as though they are one whole, one mono system of this. But do you know if these are affecting not only the typical Madagascar or the Colombian, but within that, do they reach the communities that are historically discriminated? I think it's a very important question.
Well, there's a question there.
Jaybeam, and thanks to all of you for the wonderful panel. I think I have a couple of things. So as somebody who moves in the educational space, I'm always looking for recommendations that I could use in the classroom. So as some of you have said, like having human experiences represented is possibly the best way to raise awareness. So I would love for some recommendations, whether it's in the pop culture area, whether it's novels, whether it's other forms of literature that could speak to some of these experiences, because I think raising awareness among students, raising awareness in educational spaces is a good way for us to start putting some pressure on different leaders to make these things, as you said, Paul, to stick to the ground in those places. So if folks have recommendations, I'd love to take some of those things. The other question I had was to address, Paul, you said the lack of data challenge, and I was curious as to what initiatives are already in place and whether there are any efforts to sort of work with Wikipedia, because Wikipedians do a lot of sort of, they do marathons and things like that where we can add things into Wikipedia. So if there's a way to sort of do some crowdsourcing about some of this information and to share it on a much broader scale. I'd love to hear a little bit about that. Oh, sorry. I'm Jayashree Kamble. I'm well acquainted with Swati. I'm from India. I come from the Dalit community, and I'm a professor at CUNY at LaGuardia Community College.
Anybody, Queen, would you like to talk about the faith bodies and others? What is the response and how is it?
Yeah, I think I can also add to what she said. Why does this continue? There are so many aspects. First, because of the lack of data, because if there is no data, there are no figures. Because of invisibility, they are not visibilized. Many people don't know about the issue, as I shared about how the commissioners were surprised as well that this exists in their country. And the denial also, some know it exists, but they decide not to accept the reality. And also the ego of the dominant, because most of them are in the courts. They are the magistrates, are the prosecutors. There have been some cases that were actually brought to court, but the deciders are the dominants. So if they put an end to this, how are they going to have their power over these people? So these are some of the reasons, amongst many others. And we have, in some areas, had the support of religious authorities. We just came from Nigeria, where we went for the field trip looking at the Osuka system, where in instances as the UN and even in Geneva, they actually say the Osuka system is abolished and it doesn't exist. But when we went to the field to visit the communities, it was unbearable to listen to their stories and what they were going through. But we also had meetings with some religious authorities that actually bring the support in trying to create awareness and also preach within the communities that they are all humans and they are all created by God. And where there are no where there were persistent issues of endogamy, where they can't get married, these religious leaders bring the families to understand that both the caste and the slave can get married. And they also play the role of mediators to appease the communities and fight for the eradication and the abolition of these issues within the communities for the case of Africa. Thank you.
So you might be able to find similar instances, but I think one of the law and attitudes reinforced by faith, religious convictions, because you know, you look at any of us, do we look like untouchables or people who are carrying some virus and then, you know, but the moment, even today, when I tell my caste, you know, you can see a little bit of a physical reaction. And, you know, till then they will invite you into the house, but otherwise they will still feel okay after he goes. He may leave something, you know, behind, some virus. And this happened even during COVID time. People would not sell. Provision shops will not sell to people from the Dalit community. And I think it's even in Nepal and also in several other places where this system stays. Because they feel that they will be, they are leaving this kind of a, so any excuse, but it, because there is a very deep sense of this kind of a, you know, distancing, it's called purity pollution, you know, we are polluted. So, you have also faith leaders divided, more on the side of perpetuating these systems, because then they can sell forgiveness, they can sell absolution, they can sell absolving them of all this, but also they can continue perpetuation of privilege to some, because otherwise, you know, this whole, our whole effort becomes completely, you know, so cheap that our labor, daily wage, everything, market, everything becomes very reasonable to buy the cost. So that's one. I think, Amy, to your question, is there anybody else? Yeah. Maybe you would like to, yeah, please.
No, but you wanted to say something before.
I can say after.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so just to, I mean, that's a really good question whether people really know, but I'll just give you an incident where we work also with the Fair Labor Association based out of the U.S. and have been looking at how we're looking at how brands are, you know, the supply chains on the ground and how they are treated, and when brands source from countries like India. Just a case in point, which I thought I should share. There's a whole industry of cotton in the south of India, and in one of the cities where they were sourcing to companies like H&M, Gap and other companies, I mean really big companies, where a young girl, most of the women who are engaged in making these clothes are from the Dalit community or from the oppressed or from the lower, like their backward communities and Dalits. And there was this girl who was working in one of these factories that was the H&M and all were sourcing, and she was sexually abused and killed. And then there was a huge campaign. The campaign then brought out this issue that the supervisor, who's from the dominant caste, was using his power to sexually abuse many girls in that factory. And then this was a very a case that caught a lot of international attention, and you know, and the H&M had to pay a huge payout to this to the family of this young girl. And then there was also some a new policy that came out of this case, which looked at and addressed violence against women in these, which is known as the Dindigul Agreement, which is a very good model of a policy that has come out of this. So no, actually the people who are working on the ground do not know what is happening and who they are sourcing to. It's always the person who owns this factory or who owns this and who's making profit out of this actually is the one who's in charge. So most of the time, or maybe 90% of the time, they don't know who they're even making it for. Yeah.
Yeah, on this.
Just, yes, some thoughts. I think the labeling question is a very difficult one. But I mean, I want to bring in some optimism here, because as a human rights defender or as a group that defends human rights, we always literally need to celebrate our successes. Mm-hmm. We need to remind ourselves what we have already achieved, be it being counted in Colombia and in Brazil. Both feature in the official census since 2024. These groups we have mentioned today, Quilambola and Palenque, and they are being counted for the first time in history, and that is to stay. And so celebrate your successes as human rights defenders and sing your songs, quite literally. the power of a community is not always positional power, that you are elected to somewhere or you have a certain kind of position, but it's about the community uniting behind an idea, behind what motivates people that can really change things and can change legislation in that sense. So I want to give you this kind of message of hope that we can make a difference if we unite and actually think, what is the bigger problem and how can we break it down today? What can we strategically do now to be part of the next census, to be part of the next delegation that goes to somewhere, but break it down into manageable steps. And also to those in the room who may be not familiar with us, support our work because our resources are always limited, and approach us maybe afterwards if you're interested, because the work continues and we are looking beyond 2030 to 2035 what we can do strategically to unite the different communities and have an even bigger impact on the ground.
Thank you very much. Yes, please.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about genocide now, but I will go also to this kind of a nice, actually we can talk a little bit later as well, a bit more, about this positive note. And I like the question on the kind of popular culture or how to raise the awareness on, or the particular group, maybe sharing some good examples. And I just have this, kind of when it comes to Roma, we are always portrayed very negatively. So if there is like anything about Roma in a popular culture, it's always like Roma being criminal, stealer, or prostitution, practically showing the worst of that, what kind of the civil society or the society in general think about the people. There lately, there are some advancement, and I just want to share my own experience. I've been for last 2 years. I was working with Pixar. With the Disney department on the animated movies, and they are preparing a movie where Roma will be featured. And yes, and actually because of this cultural appropriation, they made sure that the image is being represented correctly, that it's culturally appropriate. We were 8 Roma, mostly women actually, because the main protagonist, it's also a woman. We were consulted for 2 years and making sure that practically the direction of the movie, the way how it is done, it's presentable, and it actually helped to break the stereotypes and prejudices. Mm. So I think that getting into such a position then where those global industrial movie production are starting to consult and making sure that it's not just, you know, the way they wanted to show it to the world, but they have to make it appropriate. I think that's the direction when I see that there has been some work done well and that we actually can build on it. And just as a follow-up, because I was working with this Pixar, I just did also very recently 2 comics with Marvel. It's actually true that one of the bad guy was of Roma origin, but they wanted to zoom on his childhood. This is Victor Van Doom. Which there will be this new Avengers promoted at the end of the year. But they kind of make a printed story about him. It was out last week. And practically I was working with them for a couple of months, making sure that the way how they present the childhood of this bad guy, it's still correct and it's kind of Roma appropriate. But I think that this is the same somehow the direction to look. And on this movie that I was mentioning, it will come in March 2027. So we have something to look forward.
What's the name of the movie?
I think it will be Gato Nero, like a black cat.
Yeah.
We will see. It's about a cat, but actually the cat meets the Roma and they kind of share some sort of a common stereotypes, but it's a very lovely thing.
And yeah. The comic book?
It's Victor Van Doom.
Okay.
And it's already out. So it's, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago it was printed.
But really marvelous how the difficult dialogue can be so very powerfully shared with you, and you're able to also respond with this. So thank you very much. Once again, thank each of you, Johannes, Bina, Gabby, and Queen, for wonderfully sharing it. And thank you, Amy, Faye, and Jayashree, and all others who are still mulling, I think, and thank all those who are following us. So, but this is a very important aspect where
we had to shift some programs which is supposed to be quote-unquote still, you know, advocacy priority for us, because many of us feel that we have not sufficiently engaged with the academia. And it is necessary that for us that we share. So this is a very important space. So thank you very much, Swati, for giving this, and thank you, Anthony. Thank you very much, and to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute for making this space possible. Thank you very much. Jai Bhim. Opera Roma.
Opera Roma.
Lentai.
Lentai.
Salve.
Salve.
Uhuru.
Uhuru.